is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. In some ways, the story of how John Perdue became a Roman Catholic priest is a story about hockey. John grew up in Canada, but that doesn't mean he was born with a hockey stick in his hands.
My mom would tell you that I didn't like it at first, and I would cry the whole time I was out on the ice.
Over time, John learned to love the game, and he was good. His team won 2 provincial championships. But as college graduation was approaching, John began to feel like something was missing in his life, and it wasn't something he could find at the hockey rink. So he decided to check out the seminary and maybe become a priest. John was worried he'd have to give up hockey. That's when he learned something he now calls a revelation.
Every Friday, the seminarians played, and I could continue kind of playing sports and kind of being normal and be a priest as well, which was kind of a piece of my saying yes.
So John started playing ice hockey with his fellow seminarians every Friday night. He says it helped him push aside the stresses of his studies.
Also kind of bonding with the guys, lots of laughs and the occasional trip to the hospital if somebody hurt themselves or whatever. Like, it's a very beautiful part of my formation for the priesthood.
Growing up, John had heard stories about a team of hockey-playing priests called the Flying Fathers. But once he got to seminary, John learned that the team had disbanded just a year or two earlier, in 2008. John tried to reach out to a priest who'd worked with the Flying Fathers. He wanted to help restart the team, but he never heard back.
Then I get ordained a priest, and I'm assigned to the Cathedral of St. Peter and Chains in Peterborough. It just so happens that at the cathedral, I meet this very friendly greeter, a good storyteller, friendly guy by the name of Frank Quinn. And one day he's just like, did you ever hear about the Flying Fathers?
He said, I have to talk to you about this. He said, I've always dreamed, he said, of restarting the Flying Fathers.
That's Frank Quinn.
I said, I used to be their manager. Well, his eyes just popped, you know.
He's able to just tell me stories, and he regales me with a lot about Les Costello. Like, yes, about the team, but a lot of it kind of featured on the figure of this hilarious, good-hearted, lover of the poor, Les Costello.
Father Costello was my parish priest when I was a boy.
That was in Timmins, Ontario, 8 hours north of Toronto.
His sermons were, they were down to earth. You know, there's loggers and miners and kind of a rough community just after the war. Father Costello always had just a wonderful message about giving of self.
His great patron was Martin de Porres, who's a 15th century South American saint who was devoted to the poor. And so his garage and his living room were full of stuff that he was taking out to the poor. And he never owned a vehicle. He would just go down the road and just jump in a truck and take it and use it to deliver a fridge.
Imagine a priest there at 25 below zero in a place like Timmins out hauling fridges, stoves, you know. When he would say Mass, I'm not joking when I say it would take 45 minutes to empty the church. He'd take the time, everybody just crowd around him, he's just like a rock star, you know.
And the story of how this rock star became a Roman Catholic priest, that's a hockey story too. Father Les Costello grew up in South Porcupine. That's just up the road from Timmins. And he was a very good hockey player. He rose through the ranks, and in 1948, he got called up from the minors to help the Toronto Maple Leafs win the Stanley Cup. He spent most of the following 2 seasons back in the minors.
And he and his brother, who's also an excellent hockey player and a Hall of Famer, Murray Costello, they're headed back to training camp the next fall.
Murray was going to the Chicago camp, and Father Costello was heading to Toronto. And the two of them got on the train, bid the family goodbye. And at North Bay, just about the last little bit of the train ride,
Les turns to Murray and says, well, Murray, we'll see you later. I'm headed east. And Murray's like, what do you mean? We're going north. And Les says, no, I'm going to the seminary, Murray.
And at that time, he thought that Father Costello was crazy to be giving up this wonderful career that he had. But in any event, went into the seminary.
But soon, Father Costello would have a reason to pick up his hockey stick again.
This started out in 1963 in North Bay, Ontario.
That's Father Les Costello in an interview he gave to a First Nations TV station in 1986.
A young guy had lost his eye, so we thought it would be very good to get together a bunch of priests playing hockey against guys that were in worse shape than we were, like cops or radio guys or TV guys. So we had a game, and we raised $5,000. We gave it to the mother. It was better than bingo, so we continued on.
I think all the humor got added in that first game in North Bay. They only had about four skaters taking on a whole team. But the police chief was at that game. Father Costello borrowed the handcuffs from the police chief and handcuffed the goalie to one post. So that helped them score a lot.
The reason we win so many games is we cheat.
Frank Quinn didn't become a priest. He became a cop. But his childhood connection to Father Costello helped him snag a spot on the Flying Fathers as a ringer. And this is where you might come to understand why some compare the Flying Fathers to the Harlem Globetrotters.
We make it look like it's going to be a very serious hockey game. Somebody scores on us, we have little gimmicks. The first guy to score in the opposition, we ordain him a priest, and then we count his gold for the Flying Fathers.
There was slapstick. There were people being penalized for acting like a Protestant.
That's author Frank Cosentino. He's written a book about the Flying Fathers.
They found novel ways of scoring, you know, like they'd break and they'd go into a huddle, and they introduced a football. The goalie would be the quarterback, and one of the priests would race down the field on skates, catch the pass, and throw it in the goal. It was 6 points. The Flying Fathers would pull out a rule book and say, show me in this rule book where it says you can't throw the football in the net. He says, well, it's not in that book. I said, well, there you go.
And then there was the team's backup goalies, two horses named Patience and Penance.
The horse had goalie pads and a clown on his back. We'd give a penalty shot to the opposition, but the horse would generally make a save. You know what a penalty shot is?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's a free shot. Anyway, Father Tim Shea would ask the horse, who is going to win? Are the opposition going to win? And the horse would say no, just shaking his head. Flying Father's going to win? He'd say yes. By how many goals? And the horse would start to paw. One, two, three. Okay, that's enough. And then they say, why are we going to win? And the horse would bend down like he's praying.
It was just a delightful family night where people could enjoy being brought together as a community.
Cosentino says the bishops were a little unsure about allowing their priests to travel the world playing hockey instead of staying in their parishes tending to their flock.
The priest's comeback was, well, we can do both. We go on our own time. We provide funds for charity. We provide entertainment for a family so that they could come as a family. Praying and playing was the motto that they used.
So they kept at it. And then in 1979, something happened that made the Flying Fathers even more famous than they'd been before. Father Les Costello lost his toes.
Did you hear about him losing his toes?
Oh, tell me about that. Yes.
He was out at partridge hunting, and I guess a storm blew in, and I guess he couldn't see his tracks, and so on. He got lost in the bush overnight.
Blurted out, Martin DePora said, if you want me to keep doing some work for you, you better find me some help, because I'm not going to last too long. And within a short time, he heard a gun fired, and so he got his rifle, too, and he fired that in the air. The search party was out looking for him, and they rescued him.
Anyway, the bottom line is he had such frostbite they had to amputate seven of his toes.
So that he only had three toes, and he called them the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. It became international news. There were media people from Canada, from the States, from Europe, who wanted to find out more about this priest who had his feet frozen.
How much money did you all earn over the years?
Father Costello always said it was about families and working for charity, and it isn't about the dollar sign. So we don't really count it, but it must be in the, I think, tens of millions.
Wow.
It has to be up there. We have played some games where they've made for charity over $250,000.
Wow.
You know, that's pretty good money.
But as all this was happening, the Flying Fathers were getting older. By this time, Frank Quinn had stopped playing and was the team's manager. So at what point did it start becoming more difficult to put this team together?
Well, I think everybody knows with the scandal of the priesthood.
People weren't coming into the seminaries, whereas a church might have had two or three or four priests. It was rapidly boiling down to one church, one priest.
We couldn't find enough hockey players. We were all getting far too old. I played, I was nearly 60 years old. That's too old to be playing that level of hockey, you know?
By this point, it was November of 2002. Father Costello, the man who'd given up a spot on the Maple Leafs to become a priest, was 74. He was no longer the Flying Father's best player, but he was still traveling with the team.
They're on this tour. He fell, hit his head on the ice, was rushed to the hospital, had a concussion, didn't stay overnight, but the doctor told him that he should not play the next game, which was going to be up in Lindsay, Ontario, which was a short distance away from Peterborough. And while the priests were playing up in Lindsay, Father Costello took a turn for the worse and ended up going into a coma.
Father Costello died on December 10th, 2002. Frank Quinn was heartbroken.
My father was a great storyteller up in the lumber camps. Now, I'm not a poet, but I'm going to read you the start of a poem that I wrote. And it just came off of me like, you know how you feel when you're really down? So I just started off with the way my father would have. Let me tell you the story of a tough little scamp who became a true legend of the Porcupine Camp. Father Les Costello of Maple Leaf fame made millions for charity and in the Lord's name. And I just went on and on and on and on, and I must have about 20 verses here, you know. The funeral home couldn't handle the number of people that were coming. The funeral had to be held in the arena that he played hockey as a boy, you know.
The place was just overflowing. It was described as looking like a cathedral.
The Flying Fathers kept playing for another 6 years, but it was never the same.
Father Costello was the heart and the soul of the Flying Fathers, and when he died, it knocked the wind out of us, you might say.
The team played its last game in 2008 and disbanded after more than 900 wins and just 6 losses.
It was time for someone else to kind of pick up the torch, if you will.
And that's where Father John Perdue comes back into this story. In 2017, in a meeting with the organizers of a hockey tournament, Father John was asked if he could put together a team of hockey-playing priests.
I kind of sat back and it's all in my mind. And I'm kind of like, is this kind of the moment that this is going to happen? And I was like, guys, you can't have a team of hockey playing priests in Canada and have it not be the Flying Fathers.
And right there, as the meeting was still going on, Father John called Frank Quinn.
So Frank puts on a Flying Fathers jersey and a Flying Fathers coat, and he kind of, like, I always tell the story, like, as if he kind of, like, kicks the door in the middle of the meeting, which he didn't actually do, but it had the feeling of, like, you know, bursting onto the scene, and he starts regaling everybody with stories of the Flying Fathers and telling them all about the history and the travels and the jokes and the antics of the team.
Well, he's been driving me like a tired mule ever since, trying to get things going.
The new Flying Fathers scheduled their first game for January 29th, 2018.
One challenge here, Karen, is like there isn't a high concentration of hockey-playing priests, so we're actually coming from like opposite ends of the country almost. We had to just say, guys, can you come early for the game, and we'll meet about an hour and a half ahead of time, and in a gym, we ran through some of the bits, you know what I mean? It wasn't even like an on-ice practice. So we always say that the team is guided, our coach is the Holy Spirit, is God, because we're relying on grace to make these things come together.
Well, so take me into the locker room before that first game in January of 2018. How were you feeling? What were you all saying to each other?
Well, it was a blast. The priests are like sharing stories from seminary. Like some of them haven't seen each other in a while.
Frank Quinn came into the locker room to remind the new fathers to not take the hockey too seriously, to have fun and remember that they were raising money for charity. Frank didn't mention this part, but on the inside, he was worried.
Well, you know what I was afraid of? I just thought maybe it was old and corny and maybe it wouldn't go over. It's hard to fill rinks nowadays with big screen TVs and sports all over the place.
Father John was worried too.
Like, I didn't know, would people want to come and see this? Would it be a success?
Let's go, Fathers! Let's go!
The new Flying Fathers did all the old bits. Well, almost all the old bits.
The way things are with insurance and so on, you couldn't have a horse on the ice anymore, I don't think.
Okay, so no horses wearing goalie pads. But the new Flying Fathers shoved a cream pie in the referee's face. They even played a little football.
And the snap. A Hail Mary pass.
And the crowd loved it all. After that game, the Flying Fathers started receiving requests for the team to come to town. Not by the hundreds, like back in the day, but more than enough to keep Father John and Frank Quinn busy, setting up tours to visit different parts of the country.
So the next thing you know, I couldn't believe the number of... as a matter of fact, this latest tour, I've had to tell two priests, I'm sorry, we're full. We have too many players and apparently a lot more coming.
We come from many places all across this great land, wherever there's a need to lend a helping hand.
Father John Perdue is now the director of vocations for the Peterborough Diocese. That means he's in charge of helping young men decide if they want to enter the priesthood. So letting people know that there are priests out there trying to do good for the world is close to his heart. But in some ways, for Frank Quinn, this has always been about Father Costello and his legacy, which is why he's happy that the Flying Fathers will play next weekend in Timmins, just down the road from South Porcupine, where Father Les Costello grew up.
We play the game of hockey and prove to everyone that you can have religion and still can have some fun. We're playing and we're praying and we're doing what we should. And even when we give out checks, we give out brotherhood.
Many thanks to videographer Rob Viscardis for sharing his footage from that 2018 game with us. Frank Cosentino's book is called Holy Hockey, The Story of Canada's Flying Fathers. Coming up, ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. breaks down Major League Baseball's new playoff proposal. Spoiler alert, it's not good.
For long stretches of the 162-game season, it would feel like the longest preseason in the world.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month, and all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
I've been through a lot of different changes in my life, and I think a lot of these things prepared me for, you know, what we are to encounter.
That was Houston Astros manager Dusty Baker speaking Thursday in what is being called an apology press conference. The Astros, of course, used an elaborate scheme to steal signs during their World Series winning 2017 season and then hired veteran manager Dusty Baker to help them through the aftermath. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and via Skype by ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Karen.
Ken, start us off.
Well, I have been reflecting on what the hiring of Dusty Baker means, which is not new news, but it seems like anything related to the Astros debacle kind of brings us back to that question of what will Dusty do about this? What role is he called on to play in this? And I think the idea that in the last week we find out that there was a formal Excel spreadsheet developed code breaker, that there was something even more dramatic than just banging on trash cans, really does bring up the juxtaposition of Dusty, an old school baseball guy, versus a team that was filled with analytics to the point that cheating became a part of what they did. And so Dusty comes into this not as the classic guy that the old Astros would have hired, but as a guy who's 70 years old, an African-American, never won a World Series, always, almost always, got a franchise to manage that was not in great position. He has a chance to get that last piece to his puzzle to ensure him in the Hall of Fame. And at the same time, the Astros have done something that's similar to, I was trying to think of the analogy that sits out there in sport, and bear with me on this one, Mitt Romney getting hired to clean up the Salt Lake City Olympics.
Oh, wow.
Like right? You find a pristine personality, and from that standpoint, although the Astros have not done a lot of stuff right, I think the choice of Dusty Baker, especially as we see more and more come out, that he's going to be the face that's going to be dealing with this, was an outstanding strategic business choice and probably an outstanding baseball choice. We'll wait to see on that.
I agree with Ken. Watching him Thursday morning in West Palm Beach at that press conference, I felt sorry for Dusty Baker. He had to apologize on behalf of these cheating players who he had nothing to do with. He had to vouch for them and talk about their remorse when there are some questions of just how remorseful they really are. But at the same time, Dusty Baker is in really a no-lose situation. It's a really good Astros team in 2020 who are going to try to prove they can win without cheating. And if they do, Dusty Baker is going to get a lot of credit for that. If they can't win, I think Dusty will be like Gerald Ford. That's my analogy. Presiding with dignity over a time to heal. And that's a winning look for him as well.
Wow. Wow.
I like that.
So you're much more optimistic than me, Don, because what I've been thinking about is this conversation that Ken and I have had in the past about this tendency to hire African-Americans into positions where they're almost destined to have something go wrong. The Astros are a very good team, but they are a team that's in crisis. And if they fail for reasons that have nothing to do with Baker's leadership, I feel like he's still going to sort of get the blame here. And then I'm also seeing a whole lot of conversation going around like, oh, he's a veteran and we love him, but he's 70 years old. Will he really be able to relate to the younger players? Will he follow modern analytics? And Ken, what do you make of all this? Do you know he's 70 years old talk?
Yeah, it's interesting. In some ways, that's a great distractor too, right? I mean, that may be part of the mad genius as well. You know, the one thing that we have to remember, it's not often put out there in his story, is he was the manager when Barry Bonds had the biggest issues surrounding his PED use. He was the manager when Sammy Sosa had the biggest allegations around him. And he handled that storm. Both those franchises, he brought them to, you know, near World Series success. So I don't think, you know, 70, as a guy who's 65, I don't think 70, and Dusty is a young 70 if such a thing exists.
Mm-hmm. All right, Don, what have you got for us?
In 2022, Major League Baseball wants to expand the number of playoff teams from 10 to 14. That means there would be four wildcard teams in each league. Now, stick with me on this. Each league's team with the best record would get a first-round bye. Then the division winners with the second and third best records in each league would get to choose which of the remaining lower-seeded wildcard teams they would play in a best-of-three first-round series. Now, this team choosing would be revealed on a live primetime show after the regular season finally ends. The proponents of this plan say the more the merrier. 14 playoff teams would give hope to small market teams. It would prevent hopeless teams from tanking before the All-Star break. But baseball purists, even a lot of non-baseball purists, despise this plan. With nearly half of the teams making the postseason, the 162-game regular season wouldn't just be devalued. It would become an unbearable 6-month marathon. I mean, why bother playing 162 games? Why not 100 or even 82? For long stretches of the 162-game season, it would feel like the longest preseason in the world. Now, last year, the seventh-seeded teams would have been the Arizona Diamondbacks. They won 85 games. And the Boston Red Sox with 84 wins. At least they finished above 500. But there's a chance one year we would end up with two sub-500 teams playing in the World Series. Just awful. So do you guys hate this proposal as much as I do?
Ken?
Well, I'm a longtime business school professor, so I understand the economics of it. But here are my two big negatives. First, I don't want to see a reality TV format added to anything else I love. That's number one. Number two, you know, you think about in this past football season, the NFC East and teams all had horrible records in the end, but somebody got to get into the playoffs as a result of being the winner of that division. That wasn't so bad. What was bad and what used to really be the anchor is the NHL, where it seemed like before all these other leagues came on board, every team was in the playoffs. Yeah. And what I miss is the time where we used to, again, here's the old guy, I know. I miss the time when it really was the last game of the season, who's going to win the pennant? And then next thing we knew, there was a World Series, American League. I mean, you know, but again, I'm a longtime professor at business school. I understand the economics dictate that content is king. The more product that you have, the more excitement you can generate, the more successful you're going to be financially.
Okay, so I have a crazy conspiracy theory on all of this, because really, I think what we have all picked up on as the most objectionable idea of this whole thing is the live TV show where they pick their opponents, right? Like, that is just horrifying. And part of me thinks that it's just a red herring. Like, maybe they think, oh, well, if we throw this crazy TV show out there, then people are going to back off their obvious and really, I think, well-founded concerns about almost half the teams making the playoffs, right? Is that a crazy conspiracy theory, Don?
No, I don't think so, Karen. It didn't occur to me, but now that you say it, it makes perfect sense, right? It's like, let's distract them with this crazy trial balloon, because to your point, Ken, absolutely, the economics of this makes sense. It's more content. It's a lot more money for everybody, including the players, because the baseball contracts are coming up with the networks the next couple of years, and all of this is timed to that.
All right. So I want to talk about the spectacular return of the XFL, which was definitely spectacular in some ways. In other ways, it was maybe merely passable. So the rules are funky in some really interesting ways, especially the kickoff.
To eliminate high-speed collisions, we're shortening the distance between opposing players. The coverage team starts on the opponent's 35-yard line, and the return team starts on their own 30.
The quality of football is pretty good, which was not true the first time the XFL came around. My favorite favorable review said, "The players look like they have practiced. The referees know what they're doing." Sounds great to me. And of course, it's put on by Vince McMahon, which means the marketing is amazing. I am going to play a little bit of a promo for the Seattle Dragons.
Not of folklore, but of football. This is your darkest fantasy in cleats.
This just makes me laugh. But look, the ratings for the first weekend of the XFL only narrowly surpassed what the Alliance for American Football got a year ago, and that league didn't even make it out of its first season. When the original XFL debuted in 2001, the league saw a 50% drop-off in ratings between week one and week two, and that league, as you'll remember, folded after its first season. And I'm just wondering, does enough seem to be different or better or more exciting this time around to keep this league from suffering the same fate? Ken?
Oh, boy.
You're the business guy, man. You just told us.
So I was a big watcher of XFL 1, which featured the player with the name on his back. He hate me.
Right.
Google it, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's just amazing the kinds of things they did in round one. I think that the major problem that's lacking, when you see these leagues have success, when you saw the old American Football League, what they had in the end and what this league has so far, a TV contract, so they mm-hmm. got that, and they had good product. The piece that's missing right now is name players. You know, I think each team has maybe one or two guys where you say, oh, I remember that name. but for the most part, it's like going to watch your kids, not even your kids' friends' high school football team, not to equate it with the quality in terms of name recognition. So what we will know, and maybe I'll never come back on the show again because we'll see if this is true, what we will know is in the next 3 weeks is my prediction. So three games in. Let's see where the ratings are. That's kind of the telling point. It's a curiosity now. Let's see if He Hate Me is out there. And after that, people are going to want to see if the product maintains itself. The product looks pretty good, but is it at a level that people will say, wait a minute, it's snowing out here and I'm watching football?
One of the remarkable things about the XFL to me is that it is created literally for gamblers. I think its success depends a lot on whether it's going to resonate with bettors across the country. There's this boom in legalized gambling. If you watch the games last weekend, on the screen is the over-under and the point spread, something we've never seen before. So it's really important to the XFL to resonate with bettors. And if it does, I think it has a much better chance than XFL 1.0 had.
I know you both have connections to higher-ups in the NFL. How are folks viewing the XFL? Are they at all worried about the competition? Are they paying attention to these rule changes?
I think for sure they're paying attention to any experimentation that might be applicable. I think the big joy in the NFL offices about this is there will be attention to football for a longer period of time. Although the NFL has been doing a great job with the draft and the combine, and we've kind of had football year-round anyway, but here's another way to amp it up, and they don't have to pay for it.
I get the sense, the same as Ken, that the NFL is not threatened in the least by it. They're certainly watching it, and some of the rule changes, particularly on kickoffs, I know has intrigued some of the executives that I've talked about. It's certainly safer the way the XFL has it set up, and it's been a concern of the NFL for a long time. So that's one area they're looking at very carefully to see how it plays out.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and Don Van Natta Jr., whose new ESPN docuseries Backstory is out with its second episode on Pete Rose. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Karen.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Do eat this, don't eat that. If you feel like it's time to finally end your war with food, this is the podcast for you. Food, we need to talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, we journey to a remote Russian republic to visit Chess City, home of the gleaming multi-million-dollar Palace of Chess. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Sounds like an exciting yet somewhat quiet place.
Members of the Houston Astros apologized on Thursday for their actions in the sign-stealing saga, and pretty much everyone laughed in their faces and said they weren't really sorry. What do you make of all this?
I make of it that they're not really sorry, basically. They won a world championship.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to give it back, regardless of what the people in L.A. think. The whole thing is, you know, they needed something, I guess, to replace the steroid hysteria. So now we've got the technology hysteria. Look, the most famous home run in the history of baseball, Bobby Thompson in 1951 against the Brooklyn Dodgers, was probably aided by sign stealing. Except that time they used binoculars and a hole in the scoreboard. Basically, what everyone's objecting to here, I think, is the technology.
Well, so in the perfect example of sorry, not sorry, Astros owner Jim Crane apologized and then said this.
You know, our opinion is, you know, that this didn't impact the game. We had a good team. We won the World Series, and we'll leave it at that.
to me, this is kind of like Barry Bonds coming out and saying, yeah, I doped, but I would have gotten the single season home run record anyway. I mean, there's no way to know if the Astros would have won if they hadn't stolen signs, right?
Well, you can't know that, but you can't know that they wouldn't have.
Right.
And so basically what he's saying, the world is basically deal with it. I mean, fine us whatever you want. You're not going to take the world championship away. And I think we'll live with the stigma of having made a whole lot of money that year. Which is also similar to the steroid scandal, I would point out.
True.
The one great dirty secret about the steroid scandal is it probably saved baseball.
It's NBA All-Star Weekend, Charlie. So
it is?
It's a good time. It is. It's amazing. It comes around every year. It's a good time to ask you, who are you paying attention to this season?
Well, obviously, we're all starting to pay attention to Zion Williamson down in New Orleans. He got 32 on Thursday night. He's shaping into the player everybody thought he would be. Right now, I'm looking at the Celtics, who are a changed bunch of guys this year. I mean, they may not have as much theoretical talent as last year, but my Lord, they're having fun playing basketball.
Yeah. Well, back to Zion for a second. I mean, I do find it amazing, given the amount of hype there was over this guy, that a month after his long-awaited debut, it has not been in any way disappointing, right? I mean, with that amount of hype, I didn't expect him to live up to it.
Well, I watched him during the NCAA tournament last year, and frankly, what I saw was, you know, a guy who, if he reached as far as he could, might be Charles Barkley. Now, I'm beginning to think he might be beyond that. He's certainly had a breakout couple of weeks since he finally got healthy.
Yeah. Bob Knight has returned to Indiana University for the first time in 20 years. He was introduced to a sellout crowd last weekend. You'll recall that Knight was fired in September of 2000 after being accused of mistreating his players. But now all is forgiven and everybody loves him again. Am I missing something?
No, I mean, this is a hard one to talk about because if you watch the video, he's plainly failing. I mean, he looked incredibly old and not altogether there. So if they want to give him a last hurrah, I mean, he was a legend. He was the face of Indiana basketball. He produced probably the greatest NCAA team in history, the team that lost one game in 2 years and the last team to win an NCAA championship undefeated. So I'm glad someone talked him into doing so.
Former New York Jets pass rusher Mark Gastineau wants the world to know that he, and not Michael Strahan, should be considered the owner of this single-season sack record. This has to do with a sack that broke Gastineau's record. It was made in the last 3 minutes of the last game of the 2001 season, and the QB Strahan sacked, Brett Favre, totally looked like he took a dive. What say you, Juror Pierce?
Well, I mean, a sack is a sack, right? I mean, I'm sorry Mark Gastineau is waiting God knows how many years to claim the record, but the fact is he had fewer sacks as an NFL player than Michael Strahan did. And who's to say how many sacks don't occur when a quarterback just sees the protection breaking down and says, screw it, I'm going to fall down before I get hurt.
Target is based in Minneapolis, which means that those at Target headquarters should know that the University of Minnesota mascot is the Golden Gopher. And so I'm just trying to figure out how Target came to sell an adorable but inaccurate Minnesota Badgers onesie. Any clues?
Well, somebody needs a map, I think, to figure out the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin. I don't know what's so hard. If you go to any Minnesota game, there's a 6'4" golden gopher with a big head on the sidelines.
And finally, Charlie, it is not easy being a fan of the Cincinnati Bengals or the Cleveland Browns.
Not.
And now fans of those teams are being denied something they say they need to survive the pain. Explain, please.
They are being disqualified by the state of Ohio for access to medical marijuana due to sports-related trauma. Or more to the point, losing-related trauma. I think if they actually played football and got hurt, they could probably get the weed. But you can't get the weed just because your team can't get to the playoffs.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
You probably didn't get voted into this weekend's NBA All-Star Game. Neither did I. But you can be an Only a Game All-Star by subscribing to our podcast and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify. You get the idea. In 2019, San Diego Padres relief pitcher Kirby Yates had a breakout season. But 2018 was a breakout season for Kirby's wife, Ashley. Reporter Tal Pinchevsky has the story.
I am new to comedy, so you're probably wondering how a 30-year-old mom decides that she's going to come up here and maybe embarrass herself in front of a bunch of strangers. And the answer to that is my insurance doesn't cover therapy. So here I am.
It's 2018 at an open mic at a comedy club in Tempe, Arizona. Ashley Yates is exploring a longtime curiosity by taking the stage. With a large group of supporters in attendance, her jokes cover a variety of topics and include a liberal sprinkling of F-bombs, sometimes directed at her husband.
If this guy throws laundry next to my hamper, guys, Ted Bundy comes out. I'm like, what the f***? Why is there laundry right here? And he just stares at me. I don't know. So, if you haven't watched Dateline and plotted your husband's murder, are you really married?
What Ashley doesn't mention at all during her routine is that her husband is San Diego Padres all-star closer Kirby Yates.
I think a lot of the married guys with kids would say your wife's probably your most important person in your life.
That's Kirby.
We play 81 road games, so you're gone half the year. You know, they're responsible for everything while you're away. It's not an easy job, and when that's in order and they're very good at it, it makes it very easy for us to go out and do what we need to do to be successful. You know, they are everything. I'm not the only one that would tell you that.
Kirby was a journeyman pitcher who rode the bus with numerous minor league teams. After making it to the major leagues, he played on four teams in three seasons. At age 31, with a wife, a young daughter, and a second child on the way, Kirby's career hinged on the 2018 baseball season. Then it happened.
We were both asleep, and, you know, I heard her making this noise, and, you know, it wasn't like a snore, it wasn't anything like that, but it was something. It was definitely different, something that I've never seen before or heard from her doing. I mean, sometimes she makes, like, she'll talk in her sleep randomly. And
I'm supposed to tell people that.
You know, and so, but this time it was a little different just because she was making, like, it was definitely awkward. And I kind of looked over and, like, I nudged her and I was like, hey, Ashley, like, what are you doing? And, like, she kept doing it. And then, so I got up. And our dog was on the bed, and he was sitting up, and, like, he knew something was going on. And so I got up, I flipped on the light, and it was like she was almost, like, her head was turned into the pillow, and she was, you know, I'd never seen anything like that before, so I didn't really know exactly what to do. So I kind of ran over to grab my phone real quick, and I had 911 dialed, and I didn't press send yet, and I was, like, kind of shaking her, like, Ashley, like, are you okay? And she came out of it and kind of looked at me with this puzzled look on her face, like, why am I staring at her and, you know, what's going on? And it's like, hey, are you all right? And she's like, yeah.
The next morning I woke up, I had bit off a good portion of my tongue and had dislocated my jaw. Ironically, we had a lot of appointments already scheduled the next day. So we told our OB that next morning, hey, this is what happened. And she said, yeah, that's a seizure.
Doctors offered anti-seizure medication, but Ashley declined because of the risk to her unborn child. Then two big events happened around the same time. First, the Padres traded all-star pitcher Brad Hand, effectively making Kirby the team's closer. Second, Kirby and Ashley's first son, Cove, was born.
About a month after he was born, I had a seizure at my esthetician's office. I drove all the way there, laid down on the table, and I think because I was trying to tell her I was having a seizure, I put my hands around my throat to, like, give her notice or warning, and ended up strangling myself during the seizure. So woke up in a hospital with lovely doctors and estheticians around me and family members.
Ashley was diagnosed with epilepsy. She started a new medication regimen and made a series of lifestyle changes. She also tried something unconventional.
One of my girlfriends, who I'm super close with, actually said, you should go see this psychic, which I thought was super strange because she's a very religious Catholic girl. So I was like, this is odd of you to recommend. But I went. I'm like, what's going to do? You know, can't hurt me.
There was no crystal ball, no candles, just an inconspicuous office at a nearby strip mall.
She had told me that she saw me in July somewhere with a feather in my hat. And for me, you know, everything's related to baseball. So I instantly thought we were getting traded to the Atlanta Braves or the Cleveland Indians. And then she told me that she saw me, she envisioned me with a mic in my hand. So at the time, I didn't really know what that meant.
But Ashley thought about it. A longtime fan of stand-up comedy, she had wanted for some time to take the stage.
I'd always thought that I was capable of doing something like that. That's really the only skill I've ever been told is you can talk a lot and you're funny. So what else is better than going on stage and talking and trying to be funny? Very nerve-wracking the first time. I was definitely not very good the first go around, but by the second and third time, I felt like I was pretty comfortable on stage and had a lot of fun.
Kids, as you guys know, if your mom really up, right? Your emotions get up, your body, and if you're super lucky like me, you also become an epileptic. That's right, my kids gave me seizures, guys. Yeah. So my first seizure.
After performing at a number of open mics near their home in Phoenix, Ashley put aside her stand-up act for the 2019 baseball season. By the end of April, barely a month into the season, Kirby had 14 saves and an ERA of 0.56. By the time he blew his first save of the season on June 23rd, he seemed a lock to finish as the league leader in saves. And the psychic's vision of the feather? Ashley still thought that meant they might be moving.
I had prepared all July for a big move, and then Kirby made the All-Star team, which was in Cleveland this year. So that was a really exciting surprise, and I texted her right after, and I was like, you're crazy, but you're right. We're in Cleveland. We're where you said you were going to be, so... Yeah, she was pretty spot on about a lot of things.
While Kirby enjoyed a career year, Ashley got involved with the Epilepsy Foundation of San Diego. And when the time came to organize an event for the foundation, Ashley had an idea. A comedy fundraiser featuring several area comedians. Ashley decided that she too would perform her act in front of her husband's colleagues and teammates. But the Padres closer offered a warning.
I was, you know, trying to tell her, like, you got to be kind of mindful of what you say. You know, these are people that you see every day, and then, you know, you don't want to say something that you regret.
And I went up on stage and was telling these clean jokes, which is not my style whatsoever, and no one was laughing. So immediately I had to say an inappropriate word to get the crowd going, and then we were fine from there.
Well, everybody's like, dude, your wife's so funny. I guess she is.
I'm cool in the clubhouse now.
That's it for me, guys. Thank you so much.
That story came from reporter Tal Pinchevsky. With spring training getting underway, Ashley Yates doesn't have any immediate plans to return to the stand-up stage, but she has found a new platform for her comedy. She hosts a new podcast with two of her friends. It's called F-Bomb Moms. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.